I begin the talk now. This is the Wednesday morning on the 2010 Easter retreat, and I've given many talks on how to meditate so far, and I'll continue this morning. Again, instead of focusing about what you're going to find at the end of the journey, I always find it's more interesting and useful to say just how to proceed on that journey. So instead of giving you all the theory and teachings such as impermanence and all that sort of stuff, you find it out by yourself. It's actually how to get that mind so strong and take it into such a deep place. You see those things by yourself. Quite frankly, the insight comes as a natural consequence of stillness. So my whole goal in this retreat is more like to take you into stillness and let you find out the truth for yourselves. But one of the aspects of stillness is the ability of the mind to focus on something, to sustain its awareness. And basically there are two ways of sustaining your awareness on something. One is the common way, which doesn't get you very far, and the other one is this very unique way of letting go. And the more common way, which you are used to, which many other people practice, is using your force, using your willpower, your determination, or even aspiration to focus on one particular thing to the exclusion of other things. And I have to remind you once again of the very first teaching of the Buddha after he became enlightened, which was the middle way. And he taught that middle way straight away, and it became one of the key teachings of Buddhism, to avoid the extremes. And that was a direct result of 6 years of hard practice, of exercising his will to such a degree that he could go without food, even stopping his breath, apparently according to the legends, for a long period of time. And he developed such a strong will. And so if will had been the path to gain peace, stillness, enlightenment, he would have got it in those 6 years. But he took that will to such a degree, to such an extreme, according again to legend, at least, I don't know, maybe other people exceeded such a will, but certainly had an incredibly strong will and made the amazing discovery, it gets you nowhere. And that was when he decided to let go. Remember that when he remembered his experience under the rose apple tree as a young child, about 7 years of age under the rose apple tree, when he got into the first jhana for the first time in that existence. It could not have been through willpower. 6-7-year-old kids don't have much willpower. And remember the situation, just sitting under a tree, just while his parents were busy, just basically relaxing, letting go, not trying to do anything. Almost, you might say, just killing time. And there he was. And there he got into the first deep meditation. And that always needs to be kept in mind. This is the path of Buddhism. This is the path of meditation. Not exerting your willpower, but sort of resisting it, and instead encouraging this beautiful path of letting go. And what I said afterwards, don't just call it letting go, just give it some more detail, things like just being happy to be here, throwing things away, meditating not to get somewhere, but just to be here, and being content wherever you happen to be, having a non-stick mind, being patient. All those tricks which I was telling you yesterday. And you find that those actually are the way to create this focus of the mind, this oneness of the mind. The other path of using willpower, it can succeed to a certain extent. Now you can use your willpower, and if you really want to watch the breath, and watch your breath for many, many minutes without losing any, by exerting your willpower and training, 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 training. But you'll find, and this is a very important point, you find that by using your willpower, yes, you can concentrate, yes, you can focus on the breath, but you can only take that path so far. You come across a brick wall. You can't go any deeper. The reason is because that degree of willpower, which is necessary to even watch your breath continuously for 5 minutes without missing one, is so intense, it leaves the mind very hard. And it just hasn't got the malleability to turn it into the deeper states of meditation. So yeah, you can get far, you can watch the breath, you can subdue your thoughts, but you can't go into those deeper states, not even of the delightful breath, let alone the nimitta stages. So it gets you to such a degree, but it cannot take you any further. And this is actually why this path of letting go, it actually does take longer to get you into that state of, you know, just being able to be aware of the breath for long periods of time. But when you get to that stage, your mind is soft and easy, and it has this feeling of happiness, of relaxation. It's the same difference that when you have been just working all day and you come home tired and tense, or if you've just been relaxing and doing hardly anything, just spending the day on the beach or reading a book or something, you tend to be relaxed and at ease. And it's that state of relaxation at ease is so important to take the mind into the deep stages of stillness. And some people think, oh, what if I don't put forth any effort, my mind will go all over the place. Yes, it does go all over the place at the beginning. But then it settles down. This path of letting go, as I've mentioned many times, undermines the cause of restlessness. It takes away the gas, the petrol supply, which keeps your mind just moving backwards and forwards. So what actually happens when you do this path of letting go? There is like a focusing happens, a going in to the next stage. And the reason this happens is because when you let go, when you're not interfering with things, things become stable. They become still. And when things become stable and still, they disappear. This is the nature of the mind. You may even say the nature of the brain, because it has the very same nature. But this is not just a neurological thing, this is also a mental thing. They share this nature, that the mind and the brain can only notice things which change. They can only notice changes in temperature. They can only notice changes in sound. They can only notice changes in sights even. I remember just being a young Buddhist in England. Basically, I'd go to any Buddhist talk I could find. I didn't care what tradition it was. I had my preferences, but it was Tibetan, Zen, Chinese, Theravada, anything, because they were so rare to get any talk at all. And any place where you can sit down and meditate, you would go to. And so I went to this Zen monastery up in the north of England. And it was a very strange tradition for me, because number one, it was really cold. I think it was in maybe January or February. And because it's a Zen monastery, no heaters. You can wear blankets. But what really kept you awake, I remember the Sunday morning, sitting there. And, you know, you just get up early. It's really cold. And you tend to, it's cold, just scrunch up and just huddle up. And, you know, you have so many blankets, you end up sort of going sleepy. And those are one of those traditions where the teacher came in with the big stick. And, of course, I was just too tired to worry about sort of being hit with a stick, until the guy next to me got hit. And as soon as he got hit, my back was perfect. I lost all my sleepiness. I'm not going to get hit with that stick. But I also remember that, you know, we had to actually, you know, there's that Zen tradition, actually turn around and face the wall. And of course, you know, that's just when, you know, during the middle of the day when your mind got sort of bright, and you're watching that wall, you know, just watching a wall with your eyes open. And then, of course, it disappears. It's got one of those amazing experiences. You're watching this wall, it's just a simple wall, a white wall. If it's a Zen retreat, you have to have no details at all. You know, it's absolutely plastered and white and even, because otherwise, if you see details, it doesn't work. You know, the most boring white wall you can possibly have. And then you watch it, and after a while, it's gone. And of course, this is nothing amazing. This is just nature, because if nothing is going on in your eyeball, it just turns off. And I've often noticed, or hopefully you've noticed, every time you meditate, you close your eyes. Immediately, I hope you've noticed, that you see black. You know, that you see the inside of your eyelids. Maybe a little slight redness to it, depending on how much light is outside. But that's what you see when you close your eyelids. You can try now if you like. So you're actually seeing something. But because what you see doesn't change, it's not interesting, the brain realizes you don't have to worry about this. And it just basically turns off the sense of sight. Whatever remains still, after a while, turns off. It's the same with those computer screens. If you don't keep moving the mouse, after a while, it just turns off. That's exactly the same as your senses. So you find that when you sort of stay still, the things which aren't important disappear. And that gives you the sense of focusing. I gave the simile last night at the TV screen or the movie theater. And I still remember the movies and things which I used to see. And you know, even every Saturday evening, if I'm not at when I'm at Nolamara, I usually got this custom of going to a supporter's house, chatting to them, and they'd show me the news on their TV screen. And I noticed even on that, you know, you see their TV screen, and unmindfully enough, I know this happens, you can see the edge of the screen. You can see whether it's, I forget what it is now, whether it's a metal screen like aluminium or something. And you can see everything around the screen at the beginning, but after a while you're focused in on whatever's happening in the middle of the screen. It's nature. I mean, for that's just a huge, you know, sort of movie theater with, I don't know how big the screens are these days, or a small TV. The experience is exactly the same once you really get into it. So understanding that, you understand what focusing is. And the reason is because once you watch that TV screen, the thing on the outside is not moving. What's moving is the images inside. And that's what catches the brain. So naturally you go in to whatever is moving. So understanding that principle, you don't have to force a mind to focus in the center of the TV screen. It happens naturally because that's moving, that catches the brain. That's the interesting, important part. Whatever is moving is what so takes you. And that's exactly what happens in meditation. It's why we try and keep silent, you know, throughout this retreat. Because when there's ever any sound, it's so hard not to listen to it, even though it's got nothing to do with you. Sometimes I used to wonder that. You know, you're walking on a meditation retreat and somebody's chatting in the laundry, and why does that disturb you? It's got nothing to do with you. I guarantee they're not talking about you. But nevertheless, because it is a noise, because it is moving, it attracts the mind, and the mind goes to whatever is happening. See that noise over there? Do you hear that one? Nothing to do with you, the guy's measuring the past, but straight away, it's a noise, and the mind goes to it because it's something which is happening. So we try and keep as silent as possible in this retreat, just so that it doesn't give the mind something to go towards. Because if the sound is pretty sort of even, can you hear that silence? You won't be able to hear that silence for long. It would soon disappear if I didn't disturb it. That's the nature of things. So this is actually how you tend to go into things. The outside stuff keeps still. And you go to the inner thing, which is a place which is moving. So we do that, we sit down, and we keep our body still. And we go inside. And this is a whole path of going inwards, in, as we focus into the center of things. Now that simile of the TV screen is very useful, because it gives you a method of focusing when there are distractions around you. Because when there are distractions around you, you know, it's like, you know, you're watching the TV, and just, you know, your wife says there's a telephone call, or someone knocks on the door, and you find out what actually happens is the center of your screen, it moves to that distraction. In other words, instead of just, you know, watching the TV program, the center of the screen becomes a knock at the door, and the TV program is over on the edge somewhere. And that's when you lose the TV program. Some people are so interested in the TV screen. Yeah, they can hear the knock at the door, but it's way over there somewhere. And I'm going to wait till the soccer match finishes before I answer, because it's way over there, I'm not interested. You find that if you want to focus and there are distractions, keep the distractions not in the middle of your screen, but on the edge or even further away. So what I mean there, say you're watching the breath, you're getting quiet still. This is just an example. You're watching the breath, things are going well, and there's a noise. Somebody bangs the door. Don't make that noise the center of your screen. Keep it on the edge somewhere. It's not important.
What's the most in the center of your screen is what you think is important. So keep it on the edge somewhere. Keep the breath in the center, right in the middle. If there's a thought comes, the thought's over there somewhere, but my breath is right in the center. You can do that just by valuing the meditation object, making sure it's most important to you. And then the thought, the sound is way in the corner over there. And because it's way in the corner over there, you find it just disappears. It vanishes in the same way when you watch the TV, the edges of the screen and everything beyond it disappears. And you're focused into something. So this path of focusing by keeping the center on the meditation object and everything else is on the edges is the way we focus in. But unlike a TV screen, in meditation you just keep on going in, keep on going in, keep on centering. It just happens quite naturally. So the path is, you know, you just close your eyes and you go into your body. You feel all the sensations because that's basically the only thing which is there now. Especially if you're in a quiet place. And you sort of relax all those sensations. You calm them down until they become so smooth, if you possibly can, that they don't take your attention anymore. If you've got a chronic pain, you know, you're used to it by now. You know you can't do anything about it. So in the end, it doesn't become important to you. Instead, the peace and stillness in the rest of the body becomes important. To the point that the body sort of disappears. At least the coarser part of the body disappears. And then you go into what we call the middle of time, the present moment. As long as there's nothing much happening, that's the usual place where the mind stops and stays and rests in the present. So you're going into the middle of time. You are actually focusing. And you're focusing because, you know, you're not giving importance to the past or the future. The future's not moving. The past is gone and stable. Because of that, it disappears. It's a wonderful experience to see that you're actually focused in the present moment and the past and the future are really disappeared, they're not there anymore for you. You're going inwards, this is called focusing. And as you start that process, going into the present moment, you find you go right into the middle of the present moment. Because there's no past and no future, there's not much to think about, you just go in to the silence. And you don't have to make your mind silent. You don't have to sort of will it to be silent. Because it's just too hard to will it to be silent. When you start willing things, you actually create thoughts. You create the opposite of silence. So in order to get into that silence, just be patient, just keep going inwards. Be kind, be peaceful. Just be gentle. And you go into things. And as you start going into the present moment, you'll find what comes next is your breathing. Sometimes people ask, why did the Buddha teach the meditation on the breath? Why the breath? What's so special about the breath? And one of the reasons is that when you relax, you're not thinking about the past or the future. In fact, you're not thinking at all. You're in the present moment. And the body relaxes. Then what's the only thing which is moving? Because this breath is moving all the time. So it becomes one of the things which is moving while everything else is still. Everything else has disappeared, but now the breath is moving. That's why it grabs the mind's attention. So that's the way I meditate these days. I don't go looking for the breath at all. I gave that up years ago. When I meditate, I do exactly what I teach you. Sit down, make peace, be kind, be gentle. Whatever comes up in the mind, I'm kind to it, and I just let it be. And after a little while, it all sort of calms down. And then, you know, you're in the present moment. Soon the mind becomes silent, nothing much to think about. So you're silent, you're just there, mindful. And then when the body really relaxes, you're just aware of the breath. The breath comes to you. And I've noticed that when you allow the breath to come naturally, rather than searching for it, it's always a far more pleasant thing to watch. It's a much more pleasant breath. But if you go looking for it, say if I ask you now, can you watch the breath go in and out? That's always an uncomfortable, almost forced breath. But if you just let the breath come, it's just so peaceful and natural. That is the best way. You're actually going inwards. So you don't have, you're not having to force the mind to focus on the breath. It's just there for you. And you just carry on like this. You don't do anything. You don't try and hold the breath. If you try and hold it, you're disturbing it. So you just leave it alone. Your job is to be this wonderful passive observer. And this becomes a skill in meditation which you develop. How to be able to observe something, to know something, and leave it alone and not interfere with it. That is one of the greatest skills in meditation. You know, to come to a place, respect it, and just not criticize it. To be able to do the washing up according to how it's supposed to be done without figuring out how it can be done better. In other words, you don't interfere with anything. You just watch it, do the job, and go. That ability to be able to observe, to know, to feel, without changing anything, is a very difficult task. And you're challenged at every stage in the meditation to be able to practice that skill to a deeper and deeper level. To be able to watch the breath and leave it alone is a tough ask. But after a while you can, because if you do it, you get a feedback, you get a reward. Because as you're mindful of these things, you see the breath change. And if it changes and gets more relaxed and more peaceful and more smooth, it's more happy, you realize you're going in the correct direction. That's one of the great benefits of mindfulness. It shows you not just where you are, but it also shows you just how you're progressing, if you're going in the correct direction again. Going back to that simile of the mist on the mountains, if you know you're going downhill, you know you're going in the correct direction. You may not know exactly what direction it is, but at least you're going downhill, you're going to get somewhere. So if the mind is becoming more alert and the breath is becoming more peaceful, you know you're going in the right direction. Well done, keep on going. And what you're actually doing, you're going deeper into the breath. And as you go deeper into the breath really calms down. And again, this is not something you do. You don't say, I'm on this stage, now I've got to go into the next stage. This is a natural progression. The mind is focusing in. And the breath becomes so peaceful, it becomes delightful. And you don't, there's no need to do anything, because you're having a good time. It's a joy which holds the mind still. At this stage, it's a joy which creates the focusing of the mind. You just go along with the journey, you get carried on with the current of joy. And the breath becomes very peaceful. And you get to this stage of meditation, which I'm sure that many of you have been in. If you haven't been in yet, you will be soon. Where there's no difference between an in-breath and the out-breath. There's no beginning, there's no end. There's just this smooth breath feeling which carries on. And that's an important stage in the meditation. Because when there's no in and out, there's no discernible change in this flow of breath. When it's an even breath, that's when the breath can vanish and you go to what's inside it. Just like the TV screen, the edges are still. So you go to what's in the center, what's still moving. You go outside, beyond the body. Because that breath, when it becomes still and when that disappears, that's your last connection with your physical body. The physical sensation of the breath, it goes. And now you're beyond your body. This is what the meditation is supposed to do. To give you so much calm and peace and stillness that nothing outside or in your body is moving anymore, at least not discernibly so. So the whole thing vanishes and disappears. You're free from the body, so you can see what's inside of it. And as you go deeper in, you find this is your mind, your citta. There is a stage which, you know, I like to point out, which is, you know, when you first watching the breath, when it first disappears, you haven't got nimittas yet. You know, it's about to come. But you've got this state of mind where you're very peaceful, but sometimes people think it's blank. There's nothing going on there. You've left the breath. You're not thinking. You know, you're not sort of being aware of the body, you haven't got hardly any contact with sounds outside. There's no nimittas yet. And I call this, and it's an accurate description, this is when You're experiencing the breath still. You're experiencing the breath not as a physical sensation anymore. That fifth sense of physical feeling has stopped. And you're feeling the breath through the mind door. It's the mental experience of the breath rather than the physical experience of the breath. And those are totally different. It's still the breath there, but the mind is knowing it rather than the body feeling it. And it's so different that at first you just don't recognize what you're experiencing. And sometimes people think there's nothing there, nothing's happening. If you get to that stage when the breath has been very still and this breath has disappeared, not the sense when you've gone to sleep and you're dull, but you know, you're really getting into peaceful meditation, you are very peaceful, the breath has been there for a long time, it's got very soft and very beautiful, and then it's disappeared. That particular state is often the mental experience of the breath. So just stay there and experience it. And after a while you get to know, oh yeah, this is the breath, but I'm seeing it a totally different way. The best simile which I can give for that, and it's the only simile which I've managed to come up with, is, you know, you may have your best friend, you know, someone you know you've known for a long time, and they go off to the nuns' monastery, and they just look the same, you know, with their hairdo and their clothes, and then, you know, say it's Pauline. Pauline, going to the nuns much for a long time. Then one day she says, right, this is it, I'm going to become a nun. And so she shaves her hair, and Ajahn Wayama puts on a brown robe on you. And then when you see your relations, they say, who are you? I sort of know you. Your face looks familiar. You say, I'm your mum. Oh, yeah, you are. Hello, mum. But at first, because much of how you recognize a person has been taken away, you know, the hair and the clothes, sometimes it takes a while to recognize a person. And that's exactly similar to what happens when the breath disappears and changes into the mental experience of the breath. It's just almost like got different clothing, a different sort of hairdo, different fashion. You have to look at it a few times and have a look at it and say, are you the breath? Yeah, you are, aren't you? And you can recognize the details then. Yeah, that is the breath. It's the mental experience of the breath, which is a little bit more subtle. And of course, because it's the mental feeling of the breath, it's far more subtle, much easier to calm down. And of course, when that calms down, that's when the big nimittas come in. And those nimittas, all they are is experiences of the mind. This is when the sixth sense, the mind, sort of is manifesting. And for those of you who read your suttas, the Buddha kept on saying that the citta is pabbasara, it's a radiant mind, when it's not affected by the five hindrances. It's said by the Buddha several times. So when the five hindrances have gone, the mind is radiant. And there you have your radiant mind, the nimitta. It's radiant, it's brilliant, that's what it is, that's what the Buddha's talking about. So this pabbasara citta business, this radiant mind, is not something esoteric. It's an experience which you can have, and some of you have had, of this light which appears in your mind. And all that is just gone into the body. All the body has been stilled, and you're focused in. Again, it's a focusing, going deeper and deeper and deeper, deeper into things. And that's what you keep on doing. Sometimes that nimitta can be quite unstable. In fact, for most people, when a nimitta first comes up, it is unstable. Why is it unstable? It's nothing to do with the nimitta, but everything to do with you. Again, you're making it move. You're doing something. Remember, you are the problem throughout the meditation. You just need to let go and be still. Just be kind, be gentle. And if ever you ever get a nimitta coming up, please remember this simile. This helped me enormously. Because when a nimitta started coming up, you know, I knew that it had to be still to take me into jhanas. And I kept trying to hold it still. Come on, be still. How am I going to get you still? Until I realized that a nimitta was very similar to looking at your face in a mirror. Now, you've all got mirrors in the bathroom. Unfortunately, those mirrors are stuck to the wall. But imagine you had one of these sort of movable mirrors and you saw your image sort of in the mirror. and your image was moving backwards and forwards. And then you decided, oh, it must be the mirror's fault, so you try to hold the mirror still. And of course, that's the wrong way of keeping the image still. The reason why the image in the mirror is moving backwards and forwards is because you, the watcher, is moving backwards and forwards. If I look in the mirror and I move this way and that way, the image moves in. It's nothing to do with the mirror not sort of being stable. It's me, the looker, the observer, not being still. So I realize from that, if that nimitta is moving, I, the observer, am moving as well. That's why the nimitta moves. So if I want that nimitta to be absolutely still, this one here has to be still, the observer. And that just helped enormously, because I realized just totally wasting my time trying to make that nimitta still. I had to stop the making, stop the doing. It was me who was moving, not the nimitta. Nimitta was just a reflection, just an image. So I learned how to be still. And that introduces this other way of letting go, which I forgot to mention yesterday, which is so beautiful in these deeper stages of meditation. It's one which helped me, which has helped so many people. And it comes from our dear teacher Ajahn Chah, and the simile of the still forest pool. It's a brilliant simile. And a simile, as I remember hearing it, was like this. Ajahn Chah would go off into the forest, and you can imagine just walking all day in hot, steamy forests. You know, you'd always try and get a place to bathe. It wasn't just for hygiene, it was just for refreshing yourself. Otherwise, I remember a few times I was on Tudong, this walking from place to place, and you didn't get a place to shower or to wash, and you felt so uncomfortable throughout the night the next day, sticky and dirty. So you'd always try and find a place to wash. And obviously the place would be like a river, a stream. You know, wells were, you know, few and far between, but even like a lake was one of the best places. So you'd find some sort of pond or lake or stream in the jungles, and you'd wash. And because your clothes were all sweaty, you'd wash your robes as well if you could. And once you finish washing, and you'd fill your, you always used to have this insect strainer, so you could take water from the river or pond and fill your water jug. Those are the days when, you know, the natural water sources were quite clean and unpolluted, so you could, you know, take water from the lake or the stream without much danger. So you'd fill your water bottle up so you could have something to drink throughout the night. And then you'd meditate in the stillness. But Ajahn Chah said very often, oh, first of all, you'd always put your, the rule was to put your mosquito net about 10 to 20 meters away from the edge of the lake or river. Because you knew the animals would come out at night because they wanted to drink and wash as well. So you put your mosquito net 10 or 20 meters away from the edge of the river or pond. And then you'd sort of meditate. But Ajahn Chah said sometimes, you know, at dusk, he would keep his eyes open just to watch the animals come out and play. It was like entertainment for monks. And I remember many times just watching these animals in the wild play, and it was very entertaining. I remember in one monastery I was staying in, all by myself for the whole rains retreat, just total seclusion. I loved that place. And in the hut I was staying in, there was a wooden hut. There was a hole in the one of the planks, you know, a knot in the wood, and it was gave me an observation outside. Outside I put a little bowl of water for the birds. And they soon found out where that water was, especially during the hot season. And what really surprised me was after the first day or two, the birds all found out there was a source of water there. And you wouldn't believe this, they actually stood in queue. Birds of different species, all in a line. And the one in front would bathe first of all. You know how they do, they jump in, they drink a little bit and they wash and they flap their wings and mess around. And then when they were finished, the next one would go in. It was total order, and I'd never seen that before in nature. And this was in the jungles, in the wild, way away from any village. So all in order. But just as in the human species, you go in order, maybe a line in the supermarket or whatever, at the ATM. There's always one person who tries to jump the queue. And every now and again, you'd be watching them, and one bird would try and jump the queue. And all the other birds would actually jump on that bird. and peck it and beat it up until it flew away, and then they'd all go back in their queue again. Well, that's absolutely accurate and true. So this is the joy you get by watching nature. And so Ajahn Chah would do that with these, you know, jungle animals, watching them come out and play. But the important part of that simile was they'd only come out and play if Ajahn Chah was perfectly still. Because these were jungle animals, and usually any human being they encountered was a hunter who was going to kill them. So now for generations, those jungle animals had been conditioned to be terrified of human beings. And they didn't know the difference between a monk and a sort of a hunter. So Ajahn Chah had to keep perfectly still, not move at all. If he coughed, that would be it. They'd know, and they'd run away. And he said when he was perfectly still, he had great fun, just sitting there, just watching all these animals. They'd come out, look around, sniff anyone around. When they thought it was safe, they go and play there, you know, with their cubs and just mess around and fight, and just, it's delightful. But then he said, when he was really still some evenings, and this was a great part of the simile, when he was really still, then some of these animals would come out he'd never seen before. Animals his parents had never told him had existed. These very rare and incredibly beautiful animals. And they were just so sensitive. If he moved at all, they would know. And they'd run back and they wouldn't come out again for days. But if he was totally still, they'd come out and sniff. And they wouldn't know he was there. That's how still he was. And they'd come out and play by the still forest pool, drink and bathe, to his great delight, these incredibly rare and beautiful animals. Those are the nimittas and the jhanas, playing by the still forest pool of your mind. But only if you, the observer, is so still, those nimittas and jhanas don't even know you're there. That's how quiet you have to be. And that's an amazing simile, because it gives you a visual, experiential simile which you understand. So the next time a nimitta comes up, imagine you're like an Ajahn Chah, perfectly still, and this nimitta is like one of the rare jungle animals coming out to play. It sniffs around. Are you watching? If it thinks you are, it will go straight away, go back again. It won't come out for days. If you're perfectly still, nimitta comes up. She's not there. I can play. And they'll come out and play in your mind. Beautiful, delightful, incredible happiness. And if you're still with that nimitta, then maybe the next animals will come out, the jhanas. But if you move, if you do anything, and usually what people do, wow, it knows it goes away. You've blown it, all that effort, all that time, and a nimitta comes out. You've blown it. Wow, why did I do that? Stupid. So don't say wow, don't get excited. If you get excited, the animals come out, Ooh, ooh, ooh. And don't try and get your camera out to take a photo. I've got to remember this. Just leave it all alone. Don't do anything. Be so still. And then you find everything happens. You're actually going in to the nimittas. When the nimitta becomes stable, it's like anything else, like the edge of the TV screen. It disappears and you go into its center. And that's where the jhanas live. So the focusing is a natural process. It cannot be done any other way. Because the focusing is a result of letting go. It's a result of the stillness which comes from letting go. It's a result of the vanishing which happens when stillness is there. And when stillness is there, it's just like the outer covering just vanishes to show you what's inside. And what's inside, when that becomes still enough, that vanishes to show you what's inside of that. It's a going inwards only because of the path of letting go, leading to stillness, leading to things vanishing and disappearing. And you will find, like all meditators will find, the present moment awareness is right in the middle of whatever you are in right now. And the silence is in the middle of the present moment. And the breath is in the middle of the silence. And in the middle of the breath you find this delightful breath, smooth and even. In the middle of the delightful breath, just another little stage, the mental breath. In the middle of the mental breath, you have the nimitta. In the middle of the nimitta, you'll find the jhanas. In the middle of the first jhana, the second, the middle of the second, the third, fourth, fifth, or fourth and immaterial ones. And right in the middle of the last jhana, you'll find nibbana itself. All going deeper and deeper into things. And that's why that years and years ago, I sort of developed that simile. And it's another visual simile which really helps your meditation of the old thousand petal lotus. I did allude to it earlier, but if you ever see a lotus, maybe one day we'll have to plant one or two lotuses in one of these dams. If ever you see a lotus, it's closed up at night time. It's a ball, and the outer petals are always rough. Remember that that's an important part of a lotus. And if somebody had never seen a lotus before and saw them closed up, they'd never imagine that something so beautiful and fragrant could be inside this rough, harsh, leathery outer petal. But you know what happens, you've seen it many times before. Sun comes up, heats the outermost petal, and it opens up. And inside is the next layer of petals. And even that first layer of petals is a bit rough, but it's much more refined than the outermost casing. And that accepts the sun's rays, and that opens up, going to the next layer of petals, which is more refined. And as they all open up in turn to reveal the layer of petals which lies inside of them, the deeper you go, the more refined they are, the more fragrant, the more beautiful, the more subtle. And you don't need to sort of take your hands and peel them open. That just destroys the lotus. All you need to do is just to keep the sun on it. That's just this sun of mindfulness, making peace, being kind, being gentle. That's the sun. Making peace, being kind, being gentle. That's the sun shining on your lotus. You keep making peace, being kind, being gentle, and things open up. And that becomes a wonderful path of meditation. You start this whole path. You're doing absolutely nothing. You're just making sure that peace, kindness and gentleness are being maintained on this thing you call your body and mind. And it just opens up. And you just go into all these stages. And these aren't sort of stages people say, oh, you have to go through these stages, you don't have to go through these stages. What do you mean? That's not how it is. It's just, you have to open up the second layer of petal before you go to the third layer of petal, before you go to the fourth layer of petal. Of course, it's just natural. This is a natural unfolding of the mind. That's why the breath is there. It's this beautiful part of, you know, the body disappearing. Instead of disappearing all at once, most of the body disappears, then you're on your breath, then the breath disappears, and with it, the whole body's gone. That's why I call it a stepping stone over that river which divides the body from the mind. And the breath is a beautiful stepping stone. It's mostly on the side of the body, but I've already mentioned the mental breath. So it also has a little stone on the mind side. It's very easy to cross that rhythm from the body to the mind by using this breath and calming it down. So these layers of petals, they open up one after the other. And you're just observing, just watching it all happen by maintaining the warmth of peace, kindness and gentleness. You just watch it all happen. And you will always find that the next stage happens when you really just let go. It also is a beautiful simile because it means you don't have to abandon where you are right now. Because the next stage of meditation is right in this particular experience you have right in front of you. This experience which you are knowing in this moment contains deep within it the beautiful breath, the nimittas and all the jhanas and enlightenment right in the center of this. So your job is to allow this moment to unfold, to open out, just like the petals of a lotus. It also means that you might be starting off with this outermost petal and you think it's so rough, so coarse, so leathery, so ugly, that something like this can never have beautiful nibbana right in the middle. It can't have jhanas. That's why some people say, can everybody get jhanas? And I say, does every lotus have the beautiful petals inside? Of course it does. So the most unpromising person, the most dirty and ugly outermost petal, always contains the beautiful ones inside of it. Remember that. You already have jhanas, but they're deep inside this very moment. And your whole task is just to allow this moment to literally unfold, to allow the petals to open up as you focus in. So focusing is not something you actually do. It's just the process you experience. It happens quite naturally without any sort of aspiration necessary, without any doing or will required. You just watch. Let go, make peace, be kind, be gentle. Do nothing. And watch the whole world open out to see what's in the center of it. This is what happens. You're at the center of the world. The present moment is the center of you. Silence is at the center of the present moment. Your breath is at the center of the present moment. Delightful breath. Sometimes I used to call it the beautiful breath, but instead of making it visual, making it more experiential, the delightful breath, the center of the ordinary breath. Nimitta at the center of the delightful breath. First jhana at the center of the nimitta. Just go in. Every time you say wow, you disturb the process. You're making a noise. So instead of things vanishing, they just reappear again. So with stillness, vanishing, the petals open out and you go to the one which is inside. And that's the whole path of meditation. That's why the Buddha said that this is a path of yoni samanasikara, which sometimes people say is wise attention. Yeah, it's wise attention. Attention which goes inwards. That's where the wisdom lies. Which goes into something. Because the word yonisa, when I learned Pali, you get all these amazing sort of insights into what the Buddha taught. Because people at that time would know these things, because that was their local language. As for us, because Pali is a foreign language, we miss some of the nuances in the Buddha's teachings. Many of them we miss, because we know we explain it in English. But yonisa, manasikara, wise attention, what it means is just literally, manasikara means work of the mind. Yonisa means to the source, to the womb, to the origin. Because yoni is a Pali word for womb. Origin, source. So it's a mind going to the source of things, the center of things. That's a path of inwardness, which goes into the jhanas as a natural source. Again, people keep asking, can you get enlightened without getting jhanas? And to me it's a totally ridiculous question. This is just what happens when you let go. It's not something you think, I have to do this to get that. It's just when you let go, they just happen. You can't resist it, you can't stop it. It's just nature. So that way, you understand such questions are quite meaningless. This is a path of letting go, a path of focusing, a path of going inwards. It's a yonisamanasikara path. Of going to the center of things, and really going to the center of things. And a way of going to that center is allowing all those external things to settle down and vanish, so they leave your attention forever. Not forever, for the time being. Just like when you watch TV screens, that's how you focus. And it does help to get joy. If it's a delightful TV program, which gives you lots of happiness, it's very easy to watch. If it's a boring TV program about politics or something, about the latest debate between the politicians, it's so boring you can't watch it very long. At least that's what happened in my day anyway. I don't know if they got any better these days. But if something enjoyable, it's so easy to go into it and into it and into it and into it. And that becomes a part of meditation. So, remember that simile of the thousand petal lotus. It's a beautiful simile and it's accurate to what happens in meditation. You're just sitting there and these things happen. You just go in and the outside things vanish. To help the process, if there is disturbances, keep them on the edge of the screen, not in the center. Any thoughts, any irritations, any pains, keep them on the edge. Keep the center on the meditation object and you find what's on the edges, they vanish, they disappear. It's a great way of dealing with distractions. So that's the talk this morning. Focusing by going in and in and in. So any questions or comments on that? Oh yeah, Chris?
It's there, but it's not something that one should be preoccupied with.
That's a very good word, nonchalance. It shows a degree of refinement and savoir-faire. Oh, nimitta, just nonchalance. I should try this.
The problem with that is that nimittas are very high energy.
Exactly. That's right.
What you talk today is that, yeah, be cool, be cruisy.
Because you...
But really what you're actually talking about is a training in fearlessness at this point.
Fearlessness is part of it. Nonchalance is another part of it. The nimitta's got enough energy. You don't need to feed it anything. So you can be totally nonchalant and it will take you. You don't... Indeed, yeah. Have you ever noticed that feeling of engulfment, having this thing surround you, is also the same as going into the center of it? The same process looked upon from two different angles. You're going into the middle of things. Yeah, the sense of engulfment of the thing, you falling into it, surrounding you, it coming and just going right around you, is exactly the same as you going into the center of it. The same thing, it's a centering, going into the middle where the jhana lives. But it's true, the nonchalance, because these are powerful states, brilliant states, and it's just, you know, you need to get excited. If you found sort of, you know, a wallet with $1 million in, or a suitcase or something, which, you know, some criminal, so on his way back from Karnak prison farm or something, chucked out the van, and there's a suitcase with $1 million in it, would you get excited or you'd be nonchalant? Of course, people get excited at these things. They're valuable. Imagine that multiplied, you know, many hundreds of times. That's like nimitta. Wow, this is actually spiritual wealth. This is one of the great spiritual prizes. So you're really getting somewhere. And so that, of course, that excites you. That's why the nonchalance is a beautiful attitude to balance that excitement which people feel. Yeah, and I do that. And the nonchalance one is preferred. The reason I say to go in the center of the nimitta, because hopefully you won't follow that advice. You won't follow it, but the advice will be effective because I said it. That's a bit of conditioning of you. For me telling your mind what to do, rather than at that stage you telling your mind what to do. If you tell it what to do, you disturb the whole process. So I'm putting those instructions inside of you so that when you get to that stage, you don't think, you know, I must go to the center. It becomes a natural inclination of your mind because I've told it to do that. That's why I say those things. It's just a little bit of assistance. As far as you're concerned, you'd be nonchalant. you'd be Ajahn Chah by the still force pool. And if that beautiful animal decides, hasn't seen you, but decides, no, I don't feel like a bath tonight, and goes straight back into the forest, fine. You've got to be that sort of peaceful. If it comes out and says, I was still, come out. I did all the right things. Why have you gone away again? Don't sort of get into that sort of Western way of mind. Just be still, be peaceful, be calm. This is good enough. And that's why focus happens. One of the reasons I said this talk today, because some people have the idea if they just make peace, be kind, be gentle, they don't do anything, they just go wandering all over the place. They don't get anywhere. If you do it properly, that's not what happens. If you make peace, be kind, be gentle, things become so still, they disappear and you go deeper into things. The world as you know it vanishes. You go deep inside yourself. Making peace, being kind, being gentle, that vanishes, you go even deeper. So it's always this process of letting go, creating stillness, making things vanish, so you see what's underneath it. The surface vanishes, so what's underneath it becomes apparent. Is that okay? Did you have a question, Daniel? Are you? I saw you moved, okay. Very good. Okay, so that's... It's very deep teachings, but it's very easy teachings. It's easy because you don't have to do anything. You just have to be this wonderful passenger on the journey of going inwards. And when it does happen, when you start going inwards, outside things disappear. Don't be afraid. This is what's supposed to happen. Teaching meditation in Singapore some years ago, somebody came up in interview and they were really concerned. They were about to leave the retreat. So what happened? He said, look, I was sitting there and my hands disappeared. What's going on? It's only your hands. And the rest of the body was still there. They could still hear. But that was the first time they'd experienced anything vanishing. They couldn't feel their hands. And they were a bit scared. And I had to sort of explain to them, look, this is what's supposed to happen. Not just your hand disappearing, your whole body's going to go soon. And your breath. And your mind. But you know, it's lovely. It's natural. It's a gradual process, so it's actually happy and very peaceful and very profound, and you really enjoy it. So don't be afraid. That's why some of you have said, "Oh, Ajahn Brahm, you're teaching too high. I'm only just managing just to maybe watch the breath for a few seconds." It doesn't matter if it's too high. I'm just giving the overview, the whole map, so you understand the whole path and how it works and what happens. It happens so often that somebody they least expect getting anything. And they go meditating and it sort of all happens. Remember this one meditator. We were doing a retreat. It was in Thailand. And we did a 9-day retreat. And you know, she was doing a lot of meditation. I can only say this because she's not here. Doing a lot of meditation and not getting anywhere. And it came to just, you know, they were finishing off that afternoon, so I gave the final talk just after lunch. And then it was maybe like an hour before her bus left or something. It must have been before lunch. No, after lunch. But anyway, that sort of, you know, she had an hour, and you just an hour to kill, literally, got nothing else to do. And because the retreat had formally ended, she stopped trying. She got into this beautiful meditation. And that's one of those times I remember her coming to me. I was sitting having a cup of tea and she came and squatted down and just looked at me with these big teary eyes. Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Brahm, that was wonderful. I've not done something. I get a lot of happiness out of that because people get all sort of, you know, teary and just got incredible bliss and just, oh. And the reason I pointed her out is because she had given up. It was the end of the retreat. The retreat had actually finished. But she was just, you know, killing time for an hour. Because she had finished the retreat, she wasn't trying anymore. I might as well just sit down, nothing else to do. Wow! Because she wasn't trying. So that's why I point out that. And that's what happens. And sometimes that will happen to you. Sometimes you get so frustrated, you're getting absolutely nowhere and think, I'm going to go. But you ring up yourself, your husband, come and pick me up. He says, I'll be there in an hour. And so you're waiting there for him to pick you up and there's nothing to do. by the time he comes, I'm not going anywhere, husband, go back. Anyway, that gives you an idea. Yes, Catherine?
This is just like Ananda's case.
Yeah, Ananda, yeah. That's one of the reasons why I tell people if you feel tired, go and take a rest. It's called the Ananda method of enlightenment. You've heard that one before. Because what had happened, the Buddha had passed away. And poor Ananda had been looking after the Buddha for 25 years. That's a long time to look after someone. And he'd basically been sacrificing everything, you know, not being able to meditate much himself because he had to wash the Buddha's robe and arrange this and arrange that. And just like being a PA for somebody and having no time for yourself, totally devoted to the Buddha. And then the Buddha went and died. And poor Ananda thinking, just all this time I've been with the Buddha. And you know, he was sitting there and the Buddha was giving teachings and this person was getting enlightened and that person was getting enlightened. And they were coming up and you know, saying, you know, I've been enlightened. The Buddha said, yes, you're enlightened, well done. And the attendant was sitting there and said, not me, not me. For 25 years, all these other people, hundreds, thousands of people becoming enlightened, even lay people becoming enlightened, and I'm not enlightened. And this really gets to you after 25 years. And now the Buddha died, and actually Ananda cried, almost like in desperation. You know, just half because, you know, he lost this incredible person he'd just really grown to love. And secondly, because if he can't be enlightened when the Buddha's around, you know, when he's right next to the great teacher, whenever will he become enlightened? So he's really despondent. But anyway, he sort of did all the duties and carried on being the manager and organizer, and then they decided to have this big convocation of 500 arahats, so they can gather all the teachings together, especially the Vinaya. And because Ananda had heard so much, he had to be invited. Even though of the whole 500, he was the one who wasn't fully enlightened. 499 arahats, and he was the odd one out. And I give the example, if I made the announcement that everybody who came in this retreat, all the meditators here were fully enlightened, except for you. You were the only one who wasn't enlightened. How would that make you feel? Well, if one had anything, he said, I'm not going to stand for this. And so he said, I'm going to really get enlightened tonight. So he gave it everything he got. I mean, really put forth effort. Tomorrow he's going to have to face his friends, 499, fully enlightened. He was the only one who was not. So he tried that all night, meditating, walking. And what happened? Just like some of you, you do all the instructions and it doesn't work. Dawn came up and he was still as far away as enlightenment as he was before. That's why sometimes I say, how many days have gone? 6 days. It's not working. It's not working. I'm not getting anywhere. In fact, I used to meditate much better at home than before I came on this retreat. But then he gave up. Ananda gave up, so he decided just to go to bed, get a snooze for half an hour before the meeting started. And you know, all know the story. Just before his head hit the pillow, he became fully 100% enlightened. So we call that the Ananda method of enlightenment. So after this, try that method. Go to your room and sit down. You know, one day it might work. And then, just to show off that he was fully enlightened, he deliberately came late for the meeting and they closed the door and he came through the keyhole. That was really a cool way of entering a meeting. Just to make sure that everybody knew he was fully enlightened. So, that's what you can do. Get enlightened when the door's closed. Come through that sort of crack over there in front of me. That'd be really cool. That becoming a with class. Yes. No, so what it says, he became enlightened, and that's commentary, that's how he came into the meeting, to the keyhole. Because I was into the commentaries, but there it was actually saying that he had to sort of show that, you know, he really was enlightened, because everyone knew he wasn't before. So he had to make some sort of demonstration that something had changed. So they were really quite impressed. Why don't you be quiet? But if it's to your friends, you know, especially your fellow monks, And especially if they're all arahats, you know, they get sort of quite relieved that you're also one as well. Welcome to the club, Ananda. Would they recognize what?
That Ananda was enlightened?
Some can, some can't. Some have psychic powers, some don't. But you just want to make the announcement without any doubt. So apparently that's what he did anyway. So again, it's a pretty cool way of doing it. So I even recommend that here, if anyone you come enlightened, don't just come along and say, Ajahn Brahm, I'm enlightened. No, let's give a nice show. Do it with some pizzazz. You know, just like, never do sadhu, 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 sadhu. So do something like that, but, with psychic powers. Come on, you going to say anything?
The first council was at 500 monks.
Now, that's an interesting one, wasn't it? That's what it says. Where were the bhikkhunis? Where were the arahat nuns?
What about also like...
But does it actually say that, or did it say 500 arahats? Because they did chant the bhikkhuni stuff. Interesting, yeah. That's right, there were some were added afterwards. So it was the first redaction. Some suttas were added after the first council. They're not all first council suttas.
But they could be still accurate?
Yeah, could be accurate, yeah. But there's enough there. What they got together was enough. Because there's so much repetition. That's why I repeat my stories, because that's traditional Buddhism. You look at the suttas and it's repetition, 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 repetition. So I'm just following tradition, that's all. Yeah.
We should read the ones that...
Oh, you can read them, but if they fit in to just the core teachings. This is actually, if any of you start studying suttas, this is a great piece of advice which I got personally from Venwanyana Ponika. You know, he was the great sort of German translator, and I went to see him. Just maybe a year or two before he died, a really old monk, even when I saw him. And one really nice thing, he was being looked after by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi. And you may see Bhikkhu Bodhi as a great translator, and you think he's an intellectual monk. But I remember going to see him, and Bhikkhu Bodhi was just looking after this elderly monk, and it really was like a son who was devoted to their father. And no, just my respect to Bhikkhu Bodhi just went through the roof when I saw just how much he cared for this old monk and was doing everything for him. It was devotion. And it was beautiful to see. And this was like an American PhD in philosophy. So sometimes you think these doctors of philosophy have got no heart. But this Bhikkhu Bodhi has a beautiful heart. And you actually saw it. And so we were just talking about all sorts of things and especially about interpretations of suttas. And Jnanaponika, he said, never interpret the Buddha's teachings just in light of one or two obscure passages. Instead, interpret those obscure passages in light of the very great mass of clear teachings of the Buddha. Because sometimes there are one or two obscure passages which people quote. And they interpret the whole of Buddhism, from those obscure passages, like that one in the Udana, which is basically a bad translation, but most people know it as, there is an unborn, there is an unconditioned, there is an unformed, etc. And that's an obscure passage in the Udana. And people interpret the whole of Buddhism, from that sort of one little statement, rather than putting into context in everything else which the Buddha taught about cessation, the end of things. So he said, there are those obscure passages and they can be interpreted in many ways. But what you should do is take the whole mass of Buddha's teachings which are repeated, things like Eightfold Path, Four Noble Truths, Anicca, Dukkha, Anatta, 12 Factors of Dependent Origination. Those are the real heart teachings. But all this other stuff on the edges, they should be interpreted in light of these main Buddhist teachings, not the other way around. Yeah.
So if you do want to start studying the suttas, how do you recommend doing
The Majjhima Nikaya, middle length sayings, start off with Sanyutta Nikaya is good. The Anguttara Nikaya is being translated now. Ajahn Bhamani is really helping out on that one. So the Anguttara Nikaya is coming soon. When is it coming? Maybe a couple of years' time, I think. But these are huge amounts of translation work. I mean, even the Sanyutta is about, was it 1,500, 1,600 pages or something? So it's a huge amount of work, but it's being done. Get the book out.
And just read.
Read and read and read. Read the whole lot. So don't just read one or two little passages. Because you might pick something and say, that's really interesting. And you interpret everything else from that first thing you read. So read the whole lot and get the overview, first of all. And then once the whole jigsaw puzzle is together, then you can understand each little piece and how it fits in. But he was saying just sometimes people quote one or two small passages. Even like Satipatthana Sutta. It's only one sutta after over hundreds, thousands. So even Satipatthana interpret it in light of everything else which the Buddha taught. So never just take one, your favorite sutta or your favorite part of a sutta and think that's Buddhism. Just see the whole. And then sometimes you see your little interpretation was actually out of step with the whole very clear teachings of the Buddha. Because when you read again and again and again, it reinforces the main message. You know, things like letting go. Things like making peace. Things like no self or even rebirth. So those are all fundamental teachings of the Buddha. And they come across again and again and again, repeated so many times. So it's great reading it, because then when you read it, even like jhanas. You know, so, I always emphasize jhanas, and some traditions say jhanas is not necessary. Even I remember one famous monk said the Buddha never even taught jhanas. And you pick up one of those sutras collections and you read through, jhanas is on every other page just about. Maybe that's a bit of an exaggeration, but probably that's one of the most repeated parts of Buddhism in the whole canon. So when you read it for yourself, what do you mean there's no jhanas? The Buddha taught jhanas all the time. So what it does, it actually means you're getting, you don't have to believe a monk, this monk or that monk, this nun or that nun. You can actually look at it yourself. And it's just an eye-opener. And it's a heart-opener. It's a mind-opener. Okay, yeah.
Makes a whole big difference. If people want to read the suttas, my recommendation is listen to your explanations of the suttas on the net when the
work starts. Okay, yeah. But I've always got to be difficult there, because whenever there's any monk says it, we always give our little twist to it. You can't avoid that. Obviously, I'm really trying to be totally sincere and honest, trying to be as accurate as I possibly can. But you may hear another monk do that same sutta. Is there a different interpretation there? Which one should you choose?
Do you encourage that to listen to different monks' explanations?
Absolutely, yeah. Because one of the things I really sort of feel is very dangerous is like believing monks rather than believing the Buddha. You have to go to the source. Otherwise you get like the monk tradition, the Ajahn Chah tradition, or the Ajahn Sumedho tradition, or the Mahasi Sayadaw tradition. This is not what we're into. We're into the Buddha tradition. Not Mahayana, not Theravada. Just Buddha teaching.
Are there any other monks that do what you do on the net, like that explanation of
sutras? I think, was it Tanjef does?
Bhikkhu Bodhi
does, yeah. Yeah. So there's a few of them about. Yeah, so go and have a look at different ones. But the thing is that when you get the mass of teachings, it becomes quite obvious. They reinforce the message. And some of these idiosyncratic messages, which some people push forward, they don't sort of wash once you see the whole mass of suttas. They're just like one of them, just know, is jhana necessary or not for enlightenment? You know, just read for yourself. And it's so obvious, it's untenable to have any other idea. Okay, so there we go. going inwards and also going outwards into the suttas. So thank you for those questions. Any more questions? Please put them on pieces of paper. But now is your chance to open up your lotus before it withers and dies when you have to leave here a few more days' time. So sit still. Do nothing. And see what happens. This could be your day. Thank you for listening.